Hello and welcome to Cultivating Courageous Conversations with myself, Claire Tamplin, and today a very, very special guest. Now this guest, full transparency, is not only one who to me professionally is beyond inspirational, but on a real personal level, this lady is so inspirational as a mother, a wife, as a nana. She is just there's not enough word. I mean, wholesome is the word that comes to mind, and sunshine. And let me now introduce to you who I'm talking about, the wonderful, wholesome Jackie Rainford. Jackie, welcome.
Wow, what an introduction. Oh my goodness, makes me sound like a loaf of wholemeal bread. but thank you. That's a lovely introduction. And yeah, people have often called me a sunbeam or a light coming on in a room. Wholesome's a really interesting word.
You are just so wholesome in that you're just so warm and caring and giving and sunshine. Yeah, like there's something about you which is just so wholesome, and that you are you and you don't need to be anyone else, because no. You are whole and you are just so complete. And you know, sometimes you meet someone and you think, am I seeing the whole person? And I think with you there is never a question of that. You really are just pure and just incredible to be around. So thank you for sharing your time with us today. I know that you are an incredibly busy person and you are doing lots of incredible things that we're going to be sharing with our listeners. So before we start, could you please give us a little bit of background about who you are and any information that you'd like to share to allow the listeners to learn a little bit more about you?
Gosh, I could speak for hours because I'm getting older now. When I was a trainer, I used to do an introduction that took about 2 minutes. And the longer I've been doing introductions, the longer it takes. I'm originally from London. I was born and bred in London, went to school in London, in West London. And the park at our, top of our road, we could see Wembley Stadium. And that was always lovely. Went to school in London, didn't go to university. And I suppose the big thing for me about my childhood is that I was known as a chatterbox, always known as a chatterbox, and happy and sunny. But for me, when I think about my childhood, there's an undercurrent of anxiety. And when I talk to people now, and they talk about being depressed or have anxiety, they say, but I don't show that to the world. I smile, but behind it, I don't feel like smiling. And although I was a happy child and a very sociable child, from the age of 5, I experienced panic attacks. And I think there's so much being written about and talked about childhood anxiety and mental health problems at the moment. For years and years, I didn't talk about the fact that I had mental health problems, but more recently, I have talked about it because I think I've learnt a huge amount from it. And I've also been able to, in some situations, support other people because people look at me and think, wow, she's confident and look what she's achieved and she can do this. But underneath it, probably until I was in my early 30s, there was always an undercurrent of anxiety. And when I got to my early 30s, I was very fortunate to have some excellent support. And just one night it came to me that I thought that my epitaph might be, she spent her life worrying about things that never happened. And I thought, but that's not me and that's not what I present to the world. So I decided to change that voice in my head from being a worrier, which is what I was labelled by my parents, by teachers, by the doctor, to being someone who spends her life supporting other people. And I suppose what I want to try and get across today is that for those people that are struggling, that sometimes if you take the focus from outside of your head and focus on someone else who's struggling, your problems lessen. And that might seem very simplistic, but I was reflecting on it and thinking that's really the time that I started to feel much better. And also possibly today to talk a little bit about, because I've written my thoughts about being a child with mental health problems, and obviously there's some very qualified people working with children at the moment, and my observations are from a personal perspective and talking to children that have anxiety. And I think for me, when I used to run out of assembly, people used to give me a hug and I was obviously upset and scared, but no one stopped and said, why do you run out of assembly? What's in your head when you run out of assembly? People comforted me and I might have said I'm scared, and people perhaps made light of my fears and said, well, there's nothing to be scared of in assembly. You know, the head teacher's lovely. And I didn't voice what my fears were until I was 18. And so I had a childhood of anxiety and being a worrier and was labelled a worrier and a chatterbox. And I think if parents perhaps stopped and said to children, why are you feeling like that? What's in your head when you run out the room, when you feel scared? And try and empathise. I think it would help getting children to talk and getting them to talk openly, because I didn't do that until I was 18. And I think I wouldn't have struggled so much if I had. My parents were wonderful and my siblings are lovely, but there wasn't the knowledge that perhaps there is now about it.
Jackie, I can already feel that this is going to be a really emotive and empowering interview. So thank you for being so vulnerably strong in everything that you're about to share. So the first question that I ask is, what, first of all, and we've touched upon it already, but what does the term mental health mean to you? And I'm happy for you to perhaps dive into that as a child and also in today's climate, because you've drawn upon the differences from then to now.
Mental health, I suppose when I was 18, I mean, I had a phobia. I had something called emetophobia, which is the fear of sickness. And it's a very common fear, but not one that people talk about very much. And obviously I've looked up about it and I've had support for it. And you can get support for it. But when I was younger, there wasn't that information. There wasn't information for parents. There wasn't support for parents. And I think my parents understandably were worried and didn't understand why I'd become scared. It was quite funny, actually, because I remember when my mum was quite elderly and I was probably, I don't know, my 40s, and I was training and I was travelling all over the country running courses. And my mum said to me, oh, wow, just think you were the little girl that used to run in from the garden when an aeroplane came over. And I said, but mum, that's when I was a little girl. But her perception was still of me that was frightened. And it was clear that here I was as a 40-year-old and she still saw me as a frightened little girl. And possibly that's what I was. And, you know, very loving home, but there wasn't any, I don't think there was real understanding of mental health problems. Whereas now there's an acceptance that mental ill health is a medical condition. It's not just you're a worrier or a bit of a scaredy cat or not particularly strong, or you're vulnerable. it's actually a health condition, just as diabetes is. I was unfortunate as a child to be epileptic as well. And again, that's not something I talk about a lot. I'm still taking drugs for it. It was linked to the advance of puberty. And I think they sort of blocked everything together. But epilepsy is well known and well treated and is a medical condition. It was, you know, electronic currents in the brain. But the problems with the worrying and the anxiety, it didn't feel that there was information available or support. Now, today, knowledge is much better. A lot of people have had training to understand children and see how they can be supported. And I follow Kate Silverton, who was previously a newsreader, and she's written a wonderful book, There's No Such Thing as Naughty, 0 to 5-year-olds. And I love what she says. I love what she writes. And she talks about understanding the emotions of your child and getting to your child at their level and talking to them and understanding when they've had a bad day and why. And it was like a light bulb when I read that, because I thought, wow, if that had happened to me when I was 5, I wonder how different things could have been. So there's much more understanding, but it's incredibly frustrating because there's not funding.
Yes.
Or that understanding. So I do coaching now, and I coach a lot of people in work, but I also coach private clients. And I would say probably 25 to 30% of the people that come to me for coaching have mental health problems. Now, I'm not trained to deal with those, but invariably their job is affected, their career is affected, and I can support with that. But what I recommend is that you also have some support for the mental health, so they see their GP. So mental health can be work-related, can be medical-related, can be an imbalance, a chemical imbalance in the brain, can be all sorts of things, but there's just not enough funding to support those people. And the statistics, you know, for men particularly, on the problems that young men are having, I won't go into detail here because they're well documented, are awful. And encouraging children to talk from a young age and not to try and make light of their worries and patronise them, but really understand them and get to their level.
Jackie, I can see that this is something that you're deeply, deeply passionate about. And, you know, as both mothers of sons, I echo every word in terms of particularly men's mental health. And mental health for people of all genders, of all identities, of all cultures, of all ethnicities, and actually understanding that it's something that affects us all. I know that we have touched upon a little bit about what mental health means to you and how it impacted you as a child. I know that alongside your incredible coaching business that you have, you also do work to help and support young people. Would you like to share some more about this role?
Yes. I mean, obviously, I've always wanted to support young people. And I said earlier on that I changed what people would know me as from she spent her life worrying about things that never happened to she spent her life supporting others and helping others. And I have, and most people would say that I'm incredibly optimistic. And when someone presents to me, I'm not good enough, I can't do that, oh, I'm not clever enough to do that, then that's always a light that switches on in my brain that says, no, 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 I can help you with that and I can help support you with that. I've always volunteered since I was 18. I've always volunteered, and it was Age UK, and then I volunteered in an old people's home during the holidays doing activities. And more recently, I've mentored for a charity called the Girls Network, and I mentored teenage girls in Portsmouth. And I can't go into personal details about the girls I mentored, but I will say generally that these girls were presenting as, I'm not good enough. I don't think I can achieve the things that other people do. And there was, you know, people in Portsmouth have aspirations. Young people, children, if you talk to them, they have something that they want to be, they want to do. But the difference is they don't know how to get there. And one girl that I mentored, she was beautiful and bright as a button, but was predicted to not do particularly well in her GCSEs. And sparing her blushes, she wanted to be a midwife. And I said, well, you can be a midwife. And she said, no, I'm not going to do well enough in my GCSEs. And but long story short, I worked with her for a year, saw her every month and supported her to do a revision timetable for her exams and to knuckle down, supported her with some extra maths tuition. And she got 7 GCSEs and went to college. And recently, it's a few years on now, she sent me a photograph of the first baby that she helped to deliver. And I was talking to my sister about it the other day, that this girl had never visited a university, despite us having a university in the city, which does an amazing job of outreach and reaching schools and children. But this young woman just didn't know what a university was like. So I took her to Surrey University and we had to stop the car outside the sign so she could take a picture. And we were walking around and she was completely awestruck by the size of the building and what they were doing, the number of young people there. And for me, it's about, and this is what one of the Girls Network's sort of mottos was, you can't be what you can't see. Mm. So it's actually opening people's eyes to opportunities. And when I had the opportunity to become a trustee for the Literacy Hubs, which is a charity here in Portsmouth, it was very much about helping children particularly from disadvantaged backgrounds, because the children who are more advantaged have the ability to see things that they could be. You know, they go on holiday, they're taken to places that perhaps children from more disadvantaged backgrounds don't see. So the aim was to help these children have experiences and not just sit with someone and read, but to write a story and then see it published in a book, to write a film script and then work with the university to film their acting and film their film script, and then go to a cinema, so No. 6 cinema, to watch their films. And many of our children haven't been to the cinema before when they go there. And I can remember a few years ago, one of the children said, wow, is there going to be a red carpet and cameras there when we go? Because they'd seen that on the television for a premiere. And so we did get a red carpet and cameras there for them, because that's what they anticipated happening. And then finally, what the children also do is they write a persuasive piece for the radio. And it might be on palm oil or single-use plastic or something that people are passionate about. And then they have to speak their piece on the radio. So as we're doing, which is quite scary when you've got a big microphone in front of
yes,
you.
Yes, it can be.
So they then speak their piece. And I can remember one boy actually shouted his piece about the orangutans and palm oil. It's then played on the radio station.
And it's played on this radio station, isn't it?
It is. And, you know, the thought of those children listening to themselves on the radio with their parents. And that's an opportunity that they wouldn't have had. That's, you know, schools are brilliant. You know, my husband recently retired from being a head teacher, so I'm completely passionate about education and the state sector and ensuring that the state education is as good as it could be. But they can't do everything.
Yeah.
And so charities like ours provide that extra experience. And our children make great progress with us.
That's amazing. Thank you so much for sharing that. And do you know what? I was listening so attentively to every single word, but I could almost feel my inner child daydreaming back and thinking that, you know, I could be any one of those children. And I share quite openly that growing up, I was a pupil premium child, you know, come from a humble background, separated parents, every tick box of vulnerability on paper that you could have. And one of the things for me that I vividly remember, the moment that you said about having a book published, was I won a competition, Jackie. I was year five, won a competition for the Green Cross Code.
Well, hey.
And I had it published in our local library. And I then went on to a school trip at the dockyard, showing my age now, but the dockyard at the time had a presenting booth. And you got to put forward your argument for why you wanted to be the presenter, and I got it. And now, you know, I'm a published writer for Om Yoga and Lifestyle magazine. Here I am presenting my own radio show. These things do not just happen overnight. You know, these seeds are watered and nurtured, and, you know, that those little aspirations as a child, all of these moments build up to where we are today. And those moments can be empowering. And like you, myself, I've had moments where they've been the complete opposite of that. And that little voice of you can't do this, and you come from here, so you shouldn't be here. You know, it can actually be really detrimental to our mental health as well. But I guess what is so striking to me is that all of this building up that we do to young people, it totally creates the person that we are today. And for me, as what I do through mindful movement, scientifically and through my wealth of expertise and experience in education, I truly believe that the younger that we work with young people about their emotional, social, mental health, the more impact that we can have through their younger and formative years and into adulthood too. Because I am just one example of how you sharing that triggered a memory in me. And how many other people may be listening to a time where a teacher or someone in the community said to them, you can be that, you can do that. Or, that's not you, you'll never do that. And, you know, words are so powerful, and support is so powerful. And, you know, I make it no secret that even now you help me as an adult so much to support and drive my mission with Mindful Movement forward. And I'm so grateful for that. And I aspire to be more Jackie every day.
Oh, my goodness.
And I really, truly feel, though, that if everyone had someone to make them feel worthy and that they can do and can most importantly be, mental health wouldn't be such a taboo, because actually we're all uplifting each other. And this is why I created this show, actually, because, you know, it's great to share all of the successes in our life, but actually for me it's the times where my health hasn't been great, you know, not just, and I share openly, I have a liver disease, and, you know, you talked about for you the health complications that you've had. I want to talk about that now. I'm not embarrassed to talk about that now. And there's lots of embarrassing things that come along with that. And, you know, only a couple of weeks ago I was having a blood transfusion. But you know what? I'm not scared to talk about that, because if I'm scared to talk about it, what about someone else that feels isolated to talk about it as well? Because we can, and social media is actually my next question, and it's a double-edged sword, isn't it? But we can always share the highlights and the success. But behind the screen, behind the mask, beneath the person, we all have so much more going on. And I think that cultivating courageous conversations is about being wholesome. It really is about the whole you. And I was really privileged, Jackie, through my training with the Teen Yoga Foundation, an incredible charity, to be coached by Dr. Dan Sigel. And he is one of the world's leading neuroscientists. And he actually wrote a book called The Whole Brain Child. And it's about, you know, not just looking at children academically, not just even looking at them aspirationally or attainment, but actually looking at it all, because one cannot function without the other. You know, in order to achieve, we need to aim high. In order to aim high, we need to know what it feels like to achieve, and vice, and so much more. Attendance, in order to attend, we need to have support at home that, you know, helps us to attend, support at school if we've not got it at home too. And and it's that, again, that wholesome approach to that 360 approach. Now, we've touched upon a little bit social media, and I'm curious what your thoughts are on social media and the relationship and impact it may have with our mental health.
Wow, it's such a huge thing. I mean, I'm, like most people, drawn into social media. You know, I'm self-employed and a lot of my clients come via social media, word of mouth. But it's very easy to be sucked into it and to feel that you've always got to be on your phone. And I personally realise that I was spending too much time on my phone. And what I try to do is be much more present. And it's since my husband and I became grandparents and we have our little toddler grandson that we try really hard to not look at our phones or touch our phones, although his parents want us to record moments that we have with him and send them to him. So he's got to the stage where he just says, geez, if we get our phone out now. So, you know, and my granddad used to take photos of us all the time. So taking photos of children, you know, is actually a lovely thing to do. But I do think social media is damaging.
Yes.
And I wrote something recently on social media that we see a lot, and particularly since some famous people have taken their lives, of be kind, be kind, be kind. And people say it very easily, but recently I thought, what is being kind? You know, it's just words, being kind. You know, the nursery says it to our grandson, you know, gentle hands, be kind. But actually, for us older people, it's about having empathy for each other. And being empathetic about what you're doing and when you're posting. And I get a little upset sometimes when I see posts from people where clearly people in their social circle are struggling and have had a bereavement or a problem in their family. And then someone's posting having a wonderful holiday or doing something amazing. And I think, you know, people that are bereaved are still looking at their phone and seeing these things. And that's a trigger for their mental health becoming quite difficult. Or even if people are depressed or have anxiety, to see someone else seemingly, you touched on it earlier, having a wonderful life and my life doesn't feel so wonderful at the moment, I think it's really tough. So social media can be brilliant, and I've got in contact with some old primary school friends and it's been pure joy, pure joy to meet up with my primary school friends again and laugh. And our values are exactly the same. My best friend, Linda, from primary school, used to live around the corner. I share with her things I remember about our childhood, and she's Jewish. And I remember celebrating with her family some of the Jewish traditions. And she went, oh, Jackie, do you remember that? And I said, yeah, it was really special. And really, you know, coming from London, it was a multicultural society. And our next door neighbours were Kenyan nations. And we'd sit and have curry with them. And that was a rich tapestry of a childhood that I shared. But it wasn't documented on social media. I experienced it for real.
You were there.
I was there.
Yeah.
And I get so cross when I go to places and everyone is watching what's happening through their phone. You know, at the coronation, people weren't experiencing the soldiers and things. They were just holding their phone up, filming it. And are you really going to watch it all again. Just be there and be present. And I think sometimes social media has this one-upmanship of, you know, my post is better than your post.
Yes.
I've got more likes than your post. And I'm sure the people that post don't mean it, but it actually can be quite dangerous because people that are feeling quite low or flat think everyone else is living a better life. And it's FOMO, isn't it?
Yes.
Fear of missing out. Mm. That is right, isn't it?
Yes, FOMO. That's right. Yeah.
I'll get told if I've said it wrong. And it's not good for people's mental health to somehow leave them feeling they're less than. And my aim is to make people feel, no, you're more than. You're much more than. And so social media, I think, can be quite detrimental because of that.
I think for people of all ages, it can be detrimental and impact our mental health. Let's face it, the reason why social media exists is to make us want. It's to make us want more. It's to make us consume. It's to make us wish the FOMO that we were somewhere else. And I'll tell you now, my husband and I were howling yesterday. We were very, very grateful to be able to go away over half term with our children. And it was a beautiful backdrop. And, you know, as a mother of two young children, I'm not very often in something nice without yogurt or slobber or something on it. So I said, quick, take a photo. And I took this photo and I posted it up and I said, life is beautiful. Well, let me tell you, 10 minutes later, we had a flat tire and we were howling because, and you know, of course, we didn't put it on, so we didn't have time. We were rushing to get to, but that is just the wholesomeness of life because, and we were really howling. And he said, that's because you put that post up on there. That was, you know,
absolutely.
Was the universe telling us to, you know,
and
it's, but it is awareness, isn't it? It's awareness of what am I putting out to the world and what is actually my life? And I think that is when you are aware that there are many multifaceted layers to our life and we can laugh with them, we can cry with them, but we don't have to hide them and we don't only have to show one side of it. And that is, for me, an authentic way to live. When I think we have to, and you talked about that one up, it really resonated. So many young people that I work with, well, I've not done that, or I've not been there, or I don't look like that. And actually, let's just be who we are, and let's just allow others to be who they are too. And I think that's just a really, really positive and wholesome way to be.
Oh, absolutely and completely. I mean, I was laughing when you just said, oh, I don't mind giving away my age. And I was thinking, oh, my goodness. I mean, there was no mobile phones. There weren't DVD players when I was a child. We had a dial telephone where the dial went back and forth. It's probably in the Science Museum now. And we used to sit on the stairs and my dad would come in and say, is that my phone call? Because it was so expensive to be talking to all our boyfriend. I was one of four children. But I also had time in my bedroom where I didn't have anything to do. And my mum used to say, it's good to be bored.
Mm.
It's good to be bored because what comes out of boredom is creativity.
Yes.
And reflection and doing something different and, you know, making things. We didn't have a lot of money, but making things and drawing and, just doing different things, making things in the garden. We made assault courses in the garden and stuff like that. If we'd had phones, wow, how different our life would be. But one thing you said about sort of messages that people give themselves and saying, I'm enough, I'm okay, and it's okay to be who I am. And we do hear that a lot from children talking about that and saying, you know, Britain's Got Talent and people like that, young people come and they say, you know, I was bullied or I'm not confident, but I've realised I'm enough. And I, for a long time in my coaching, I've been saying to people, when you talk to yourself, when you're on your own and you're chattering away in your head, how do you talk to yourself? What do you say? And people look at me because I know what they're going to say. They're going to say, well, I beat myself up. I tell myself off. I say, oh, you're stupid. Why did you do that? And why did you make that mistake? And almost everyone that comes for coaching says that at some time or other, you know, I beat myself up about stuff. And I say, okay, well, who's your best friend? You know, I was doing some coaching with a young man recently. I said, who's your best friend? And I said, if your best friend was sitting next to you saying the things that you're saying, what would you say to him or her? Well, I'd say, no, you're really good at that. Don't think that. And what about that? Well, you might not be so good at that, but what about this? You're fantastic at this. And I said, OK, so what you need to do is talk to yourself in exactly the same way as if your best friend was sitting next to you. And when people start practicing positive self-talk, I don't want to use too much medical jargon, but it is positive self-talk. If you say, when you're lying in bed, and I, as a child, I described it to the doctor that it feels like I've got worms in my head. Sounds disgusting, doesn't it? Like something out of a Harry Potter movie. But my brain was just moving and I couldn't stop it and I couldn't still it, because I could feel myself saying, why do I run out of things? Why can't I stay? Why don't I want to do this? Why? And I didn't have the answers to any of those questions. But I did have lots of lovely friends. And if I'd just talked to myself how I was talking to my friends, it would have helped. So there's some really simple strategies that I think we can all learn. And, you know, I've been through struggles and difficulties and bereavements and, you know, my mental health, as I've already said, you know, when I was younger and really until I was in my 30s, was up and down. But I've got to a place now where I think, wow, you know, I do talk to myself more positively. You know, sometimes things happen and it wears me down, normally when I get tired. And then I think, right now, stop. And then I described it to someone the other day, and I need to coin the phrase decompression coaching.
I love that.
Yeah. So, and obviously anyone that does diving, I mean, we're by the coast, so there's probably maybe some divers, you know, decompression is, you know, you go down and too quickly and it obviously affects your body. Well, it's the same in life. You know, things happen to you and your body takes a hit, the adrenaline and so on. But what happens is someone doesn't sit with us and decompress us.
Yeah.
And say, God, that must have been awful. Talk to me about it. How do you feel? And how do you feel now? And what can we do to help support you with that? So I'd love to see more decompression coaching. And I know you work with schools. I'd love to see it in schools with teachers, because teachers are on a roller coaster day in, day out, as a lot of people are with their careers. Yeah. I mean, the police, NHS, any job, really. I'd like to see more people trained to do decompression coaching. Mm. So this is what's happened to you. Let's talk you down. Let's get your air in your lungs again.
Yes.
And your brain, and to still those worms in the brain.
Yes.
And to get you, okay, that happened. We can't deny it happened, but I can move on from this. Can I just talk about resilience for a moment?
Please, please.
Because I posted something on social media, on LinkedIn recently, about resilience, because there's a lot of discussion about the word resilience. When Michael Gove was education secretary, he kept going on about resilience, resilience, we all need resilience. Well, actually, no, it's what he was talking about was endurance. And we're not all marathon runners. We're not all running a race, and because we haven't had the training for it and the development, and we haven't prepared our bodies. What he was talking about is he just wants people to endure. Well, no, I don't think we all need to endure. Resilience to me is not the ability to bounce back, which is the physics term. It's when a metal is heated, or something is heated, or a plastic is bending, and then it goes back to its original shape. Resilience to me is your ability to move with a situation and then reflect on it and then move on to a new state. you never go back. So, you know, take, for example, when I lost my dad, it was awful. And I was in my early 30s and it was awful for all of us. And I did have some counselling for it. I was never going to go back to the person that I was beforehand. Yeah. Because, when you lose a parent, you experience something awful. But with support and help, I moved on to a different place of understanding. And that's what resilience is about. It's actually, things are going to happen. You know, none of us is immune to bad things happening, unfortunately. But what we need to do is support each other through those things so that, like a little rough stone in the sea that's bashed against the rocks, we move on when the waves settle and eventually we come the most beautiful round stone on the beach. We're never, ever going to go back. We always move forward. People say to me, are you ever going to stop and retire? I'm 64. I don't mind telling people. I'm not ageist at all, because you can keep going forever as long as you have positivity and a desire to do something. You know, as I walked up here, I was talking to someone about doing art, and it was something I did as a child, and maybe that's something I'll pick up in the future. But absolutely, we're always work in progress, and there's always an opportunity to do more. And I mentioned earlier on that I've been volunteering since I was 17. And when I was probably depressed, actually, after my dad died, the counsellor said to me, you know, you've always volunteered. What does volunteering do for you? And I said, well, it makes me focus on other people and reflect on other people. And she said, perhaps it would help you to do some volunteering one-to-one with people. So I went to Age UK and I did some home visiting for a while. And I think that's true for a lot of people. A lot of people that are volunteering and doing things for others, it's because they've struggled or been struggling themselves.
Totally.
And sometimes focusing on other people is really helpful for your mental health, and actually not being inside your head and thinking it's all about me, but opening up your world a little bit.
Yes, and that vulnerability is actually quite contagious, because all it takes is to say, you know, this is how I'm feeling, or this is why. And take my event, It Takes a Village, for example. I do it completely for free. The money that is made goes back into schools. However, the amount of people that turn up there and openly say, you know, I'm really struggling at the moment. I'm coming here because I know it's going to a good cause, but I really need this too right now. Or the amount of people that will say when they hear my story, I had no idea that that's what happened, and that's why you do what you do. And there's so many people that you find their struggles actually become the reason for their growth. Very rarely is it the success, the awards, the limelight, the titles, the everything. Actually, let's be real, it doesn't mean anything, because we all have feelings. We all go to bed at night. We all lay our head on the pillow and we know deep down, have I helped people today? Have I done a good job? Am I being true to myself? Because sometimes we can get, like social media, stuck in that trap of, you know, wanting that recognition. But actually, my experience of that is I actually become less confident in myself. I second guess myself. I seek that external validation as opposed to, no, I'm laying down tonight, putting my head on the pillow, and I know I've done a good job. I know I've been true to myself. I've been true to my values. I've led with my heart and integrity. But sometimes that all those other, you know, external things can really create a lot of noise or worms, as I'm going to say, in our head.
Absolutely. Well, that was a childhood perspective. But it's just interesting to hear adults talking to children and what they say and what they do. And, you know, seeing the world through my little grandson's eyes, who's just starting to talk. His mum, sparing her blushes, does a wonderful thing. And it touches my heart every time she does it. if he falls down and hurts himself, she scoops him up and gives him a huge cuddle, as all mums would do. And if he's crying, she says to him, right, she said, put your tears on my heart. So he puts his finger up to his eyes and he touches his tears and then he puts them on her heart. And every time I've seen her do that, it touches my heart as well, because he's not wasting his tears. His tears are being taken by someone who's bigger and taking care of him. And isn't that a lovely metaphor for life?
Mm.
You know, we don't all cry tears of pain, because somehow we're taught as we grow up not to do that.
Yes.
And I don't necessarily think that's a good thing, because tears, if you read about the process of crying, it's really cleansing and washing and makes you feel exhausted.
Totally.
It does me and gives me puffy eyes.
If we were scientists and we took a little pipette of our tears, we'd actually find cortisol, the stress hormone, in our tears. It's our body's way of releasing stress,
yeah,
which is why you feel exhausted after. But here's the thing, the amount of people, and, you know, don't cry, stop crying,
yeah,
you know, and actually there's so much of our human nature that is denied, isn't it, to this fast-paced, you know, target-led world. And actually, sometimes we just need to be whole.
Well, absolutely, completely. And even when my anxiety was bad, I didn't cry a lot, which was interesting, because I think I was just so totally into my head. But I just, watching her do that just made me think, isn't that a lovely metaphor for life? That actually, if you're crying, you just want someone to scoop you up and say, I'll take your tears and I'll share them. And, you know, we're not going to wipe them away with the tissue.
I'm going to open
my scratchy
heart.
Tissue.
Yeah. Clinical.
Excuse me. Sorry, I'm frogging my throat.
No,
not a scratchy tissue or anything. Those tears are going into my heart and I'm supporting them. And I just thought about it the other day. It's coming back to this metaphor of empathy.
Mm.
And what is empathy? And it's not just about being kind, because what does kindness mean? I'd love to know. I'd love to know what your listeners think kindness means.
Mm.
But it's actually being empathetic. It's being present. It's noticing. It's really listening. And it's not sympathy, because you don't have to feel what the other person's feeling. It's actually acknowledging that they're struggling.
The Wizard of Oz syndrome. Tell me a little bit about that, because I know it's something you're keen to share and I find it so fascinating.
Well, I can't remember where I read about this. It was years and years ago. Years and years ago. I read about people who have a power over other individuals. So that might be teachers, head teachers, HR directors, leaders in businesses, even parents. And what someone who's perhaps a little vulnerable or a little thinking, oh, I don't know whether I'm good at this, or I'd like that promotion, or they have the power to do that. What we're investing in those people is the Wizard of Oz syndrome. And we feel they have the power to make that difference for us. And as we know, if you've watched the Wizard of Oz film, what happens is they all go down the yellow brick road with all their wants and desires. And they get to the Wizard of Oz and he starts talking to them. And of course, the screen falls down and it's just an old man with a microphone. And, you know, actually, the people that we invest all this power and authority in, well, they're not just old men with microphones, but they're just human beings as well. They're just human beings as well. And they've had vulnerabilities and problems and they've got to where they are because they've been good at things and worked hard, but they're not the Wizard of Oz. They're not the Wizard of Oz. They're just another human being. And two things for that. First of all, the people expecting those people to give them the power, just remember that. But also for those people who are the Wizard of Oz, be very careful what you say, because your words will be magnified like the Wizard of Oz, and they will hurt and they will damage, or they will empower. And I think we all know examples of friends that have said, oh, do you know, I had a teacher when I was a child that said that to me. Or I had a boss that said, oh, you'll never make anything. Or you've been written off by someone. And they've misused their Wizard of Oz power.
Totally. And do you know what the beauty of it was? It was within Dorothy all along.
Yeah, absolutely.
The magic is within.
You took my final line away. And the Scarecrow and the Lion and everybody else.
Oh, thank you, Jackie. It has been a joy, such a joy to be with you today. I will look forward to hearing what the listeners believe for them is kindness too. Take care, Jackie. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.